Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to our half-year results presentation. I'm conscious it's a very busy day for results today, with Legal & General's presentation at 10:30 this morning, I believe. So I do promise I'll do my very best to get you away from here by, say, lunchtime. Joking aside, we will be relatively brief because, having clearly set out our strategy back in March and May, today is all about updating against that strategy and how we're getting on in the execution of our strategy, and I'm pleased with the progress we've made. The key messages can be summarized under the two key goals of our financial framework. In terms of cash today, we're making good progress in building towards our 1.3x coverage target. The Lombard disposal and increased share buyback improves our pro forma 2013 dividend coverage ratio. And then, our sustainable free surplus in the first half of this year is up 15% and on track for low double-digit percentage growth at the full year. Suffice to say, we are confident that, in due course, we will get to the 1.3x coverage target. So my key focus is growing cash tomorrow to support our future progressive dividend. Again, our execution in the first half is pleasing. The continued delivery of our program of revenue optimization initiatives will add a further 10 million pounds per annum to expected return from 2015, and there's more to come from future potential initiatives. On corporate benefits, we've had strong net fund flows and hence have grown underlying free surplus from 11 million pounds for the full year in 2013 to 14 million pounds already at the half year this year. And on retirement income, our focus has been on further building our customer engagement. I'm particularly pleased with how this has driven good annuity sales, both in Q1 and Q2. The superior capability in customer engagement that we're building leaves us well placed for the post-budget world. Alongside this, we are further developing our market-leading platform. Overall, our progress in executing on our strategy gives me high confidence in our ability to grow cash going forward. Before I hand over to Tim to cover the results in more detail, I do want to mention the Lombard disposal. It was a while in the gestation, but I'm pleased with the outcome. In particular, I'm delighted to announce today that we've received PRA approval, given the strength of our balance sheet, to return the full initial consideration. Hence, we are increasing the share buyback to 317 million pounds from the 261 million pounds previously announced. The deal demonstrates our commitment to securing maximum value from each part of the group and returning cash to shareholders where appropriate. The larger share buyback improves the 2013 pro forma dividend coverage from 1.1x to 1.17x, and the pro forma capital coverage remains strong. So in terms of agenda today, I'll be back shortly to update on the execution of our strategy, but first I'll hand over to Tim to cover our interim 2014 trading update. Tim.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Andy, and good morning, everybody. So before I get into the results, I'd just like to highlight a couple of things on the presentation of our numbers this morning. Firstly, following the announcement of the sale of Lombard, this business is now treated as discontinued and doesn't feature in our operating results in either year. Now, a full reconciliation of the headline measures to those shown before is within the appendix to your presentation deck. Secondly, and as planned, we completed the transfer of the non-core OLAB business from International to Heritage at the end of last year. We've therefore restated the 2013 results for these divisions to ensure comparability. Now, you saw most of the new business restatement effect with our first quarter numbers, but you'll find everything in the release today, including balance sheet EV splits. So let's look at the numbers which we are presenting today using the financial framework, which I set out in March. Well, I'm delighted at the continued growth in SFS with £163 million delivered in the first half of the year. This is supported by good growth in free surplus expected return, also shown centre top here, which has increased by 2%. Our IFRS and MCV results are down marginally on last year, principally reflecting continued pressure on the international business and the predicted margin compression in retirement income. This has, as expected, resulted in lower value of new business contribution in MCV and a reduced new business strain benefit in the IFRS result. I'll cover both of these in more detail later. Our capital base remains strong on both an economic and an IGCA basis. and in line with our stated dividend policy, we've maintained our interim dividend at 7.05 pence per share. So let's get stuck in by looking at sustainable free surplus in more detail. At a group level, SFS has grown significantly. Importantly, this also reflects a good underlying free surplus performance with expected return growth and lower investment in new business. On development spend, we originally guided to a circa £15 million increase in development spend for this year, principally to be invested in retirement income. But we have pulled back substantially on our initial proposal for this spend, and as you can see here, there is only a £2 million increase at half time. We no longer expect anything like the originally guided increase, although I am excluding from this comment and from our SFS guidance future costs associated with product and platform development. These will be reported separately and are not expected to exceed £30 million this year. Looking at the performance at a divisional level, it's clear that the group result is underpinned by the Heritage division. And I flagged many of the drivers of this performance earlier this year, and I will look at the increased expected returns in just a second. Across the other divisions, sustainable free surplus is lower, with the UK division result largely reflecting reduced retirement income margins and some adverse protection claims experience, whilst challenging markets continue to impact international. Our cash returns ratio, being our measure of free surplus generation as a proportion of shareholder net worth, has improved on last year. Overall, this is continued strong cash generation progress, and following the 7% growth in SFS achieved in full year 2013, from £304 million to £325 million, I'm very pleased to confirm that we expect to achieve further low double-digit percentage growth in SFS for the full year 2014. So let's now discuss the growth in expected returns. Well, back in March, I shared with you our expectation for the emergence of surplus from our UK and Heritage in-force books, with a £39 million uplift expected this year. You can see this in the mini chart on the left-hand side of the slide. I'm delighted to be able to report £23 million of the £39 million uplift has been achieved in the first half, and I'm confident of delivery of the remaining element in the second half. The growth has been achieved through initiatives delivered in both divisions, with Heritage initiatives including phase one of the with-profits annuity reallocation and asset transfers to FLI, and the UK division benefiting from last year's new business growth. We continue to focus on improving surplus generation, and we expect further benefits to be delivered through initiatives such as the second phase of the with-profit annuity reallocations and the asset recapture work we are doing to bring further assets onto the FLI and Schroders platforms. Let's go through the businesses in a bit more detail, starting with Heritage. Well, the drivers of the 7% increase in Heritage expected return are shown on the right-hand side of the slide and are in line with my March presentation. But I do want to briefly comment on the impact of the transfer of the OLAB business into Heritage. The table on the bottom left shows the impact of this transfer on the Heritage result, and as you can see, there has been no net impact on the trend in expected return. However, the OLAB transfer has reduced the cost of investment in new business this year. OLAB new business was ceased, barring increments, at the end of Q3 2013 and has driven £15 million of the £17 million reduction in Heritage INB this half. Overall, this is a strong performance from Heritage. Now let's look at our asset-based business, corporate benefits. How would I sum up the overall corporate benefits performance? Well, I have to say that I think it's terrific. The growth in the business has driven income up to £60 million, equivalent to 60 basis points on opening assets, while outgoings have been held flat at £47 million. This in turn equates to 47 basis points of outgoings, which is a 6 basis point improvement on last year. This is a clear improvement in operating leverage, and this drives the increase in underlying free surplus generation, which is at £14 million for the half, against a total of £11 million for the whole of last year. Growth in the business has fuelled another good period of net fund inflows of £0.4 billion, and investment performance has moved from negative at Q1 to an overall plus £0.3 billion for the half. New member growth through auto-enrolment remains the principal driver of growth, with the second quarter of the year expected to represent a clear peak in new scheme enrolments. The first half of the year has shown strong growth on this front, with 648 new schemes enrolled. In total, the group has added a net 108,000 new employees to its membership, bringing the total to 1.25 million. With this supporting the APE and regular premium growth of 30% and 4% respectively. All in all, terrific progress. Moving now on to the open insurance businesses and starting with protection then. Well, protection business has delivered a strong start to the year with volume growth up 21%, with value of new business close to flat on last year at £31 million, and the underlying free surplus generation is flat at minus £7 million. Growth in this business has been driven by the individual protection proposition, although some of this growth reflects the comparative market weakness at the beginning of 2013. Across the protection business as a whole, however, there has been some tightening of margins, with more competitive pricing in the individual protection market a contributory factor, as well as a shift of mix in group protection business to the lower margin group life product. Financial discipline continues to be key in this price-driven market. The cost of writing new business remains an important factor, and we have worked hard to manage the cash strain dynamics. As a result, the cost of investing in new business has increased by just 5%, and thus at a much lower rate than new business volumes. So overall, my scorecard-type view of protection would be strong sales progress, but only a satisfactory cash performance. Next, retirement income. Well, the market is still adjusting to the changes announced in the Chancellor's budget, and Andy will talk in a minute about the product and platform and other activities that we're undertaking to win in this new world. The business contribution from underlying free surplus, shown on the left at a £6 million loss, is a continuation of the trend that we saw in the second half of last year, and is much more about conscious increases in the competitiveness of the product than impacts of the Chancellor's budget. This is also the case in VNB and margin trends shown top right. We have some excellent annuity products and are committed to maintaining a competitive product suite, although we would hope that any further margin compression from here would be modest. Notwithstanding all this, volumes are close to flat in the first half, showing little budget impact, although we do expect annuity sales to fall over time, as we have previously said. Importantly, first half sales reflect a high proportion of GAO-related business, which is 53% of first half volumes. But they're also testament to our successful customer engagement model. This performance compares well to a general trend for individuals to defer their retirement decisions even before the budget announcement. In the international division, cash generation is clearly disappointing, although this does reflect the trends that we have reported recently. The underlying free surplus contribution has reduced to plus £14 million in the period, with the reduction in expected return only partially offset by a reduction in the cost of investment in new business. The business has continued to suffer from market disruption and local market reviews, particularly in Hong Kong, where the market has shrunk, as we discussed at Q1. In addition, we are also facing continued competitive pressures in Singapore and the Middle East, but we are maintaining our focus on financial discipline. The delivery of free surplus, and importantly the ability to grow free surplus, is a key part of the business being able to deliver its dividend targets. The difficult trading environment has impacted sales and thus SFS, but this effect has been compounded by adverse exchange rate movements and a likely shift to the Hong Kong capital regime becoming the biting capital constraint for the company, to mean that the interim dividend has been passed and the final dividend will be kept under review. We're very focused on addressing the recent poor performance and have a number of initiatives underway, some of which have led to Q2 sales being marginally better than Q1, and July looks encouraging. In addition, the business is investing heavily in its capabilities, with platform development continuing to progress well and is expected to be ready to accept new business on the platform at the end of the third quarter. The in-force book will be transferred in 2015, leaving this business better able to compete in its chosen markets. Let's move on to the IFRS result. Well, operating profit on an IFRS basis is down 7% on last year. At a group level, the drivers principally reflect a slight reduction in in-force surplus and that is largely driven by lower positive mortality experience in 2014. This has, however, been more than offset by higher returns on shareholder assets, which are in line with guidance. Development costs have also been tightly managed, as I set out when we discussed SFS earlier. We've made some modest one-off modelling changes, but otherwise the results are in line with the first half of 2013. At a divisional level, the period-on-period performance is similar to that in SFS, with the Heritage division delivering increased returns through reduced new business strain in the recently transferred OLAB business and improved economic factors, driving higher in-force surplus and returns on shareholder assets. In UK, we've experienced a lower result because of our decisions to improve annuity pricing. Looking at the IFRS result as a waterfall, I've set out here the key components of the period-on-period change. Starting here on the left and finishing on the right, with the removal of the half-year 2013 and 2014 principal reserving changes. Across the middle, here in the dotted box, I have split new business strain into two, with this highlighting the benefit of reduced non-core OLAB sales, offset by the consciously reduced margins in retirement income. The next box here highlights the drivers of in-force surplus generation, with this reflecting the additional surplus delivered by the first phase of the with-profits annuity reallocation, offset by the lack of positive protection mortality experience that I referred to just a moment ago. Finally, and as I mentioned on the previous slide, you can see here the benefit of improved expected rates of return on shareholder assets. Moving on to MCV, briefly, I won't spend a great deal of time here as the key drivers are the same as those that we've talked through already on SFS and IFRS. At the headline level, MCV result is marginally lower, 5% down on last year, largely a result of a lower contribution from new business, mainly from retirement income, of course, and international. This is partially offset by a 15% increase in the expected existing business contribution, which, as I reported at year-end, has benefited from improved opening rates of return. Elsewhere, the results are broadly in line with last year, with the capitalisation of lower investment expenses and an increase in the recognition of deferred tax assets shown in the line called operating assumption changes. Let me finish by looking at capital. And as you would expect, not much has changed, really. The group has continued to maintain strong economic and IGCA capital bases. Available shareholder assets also remain strong, and we have further enhanced the returns achievable on these assets, with more than two-thirds of the £200 million syndicated loan mandate already invested at the end of June this year. In line with our stated dividend policy, we've maintained our interim dividend. In addition, and supported by our capital strength, like Andy, I am delighted that we have received PRA approval to increase our proposed share buyback to the full £317 million consideration from the Lombard sale. The share buyback will commence when the sale has been completed and proceeds received. I expect you'll be getting your calculators out shortly to do the maths on when we might start a progressive dividend. But when I look at it, I also remember that the average share price at which the share buyback will be done is unknown. And of course, a key part of our annual SFS is expected return, where 1 January economic factors are key and cannot be predicted in advance. So there are a number of factors to take into account. And with that, I'll hand you back to Andy so we can get stuck into the progress that we've made on executing against our strategy.
Thank you, Tim. So as Tim's covered, we're making good progress to our cash delay target of 1.3 times dividend coverage, and I therefore want to focus on growing cash tomorrow by updating on how we're executing against our strategy and leveraging the strong market positions we have to drive growing cash and hence support our future progressive dividend. You'll recognise this chart, recapping the strategy we previously set out. I want to focus on three key areas where there's significant market change or where we're investing. That's not to diminish the importance of other areas such as protection and FPI, but just as there is less change in these markets. And Nigel would never forgive me if I did keep you till lunchtime. Three areas are, firstly, our revenue optimisation initiatives, secondly, corporate benefits, and thirdly, retirement income. So I'll talk about our execution and delivery in the first half in each of these three growth areas, And our goal is to grow cash to more than offset the runoff of the in-force book, which we covered back in March as roughly 30 million pounds per annum in the shorter term and 10 million pounds per annum in the longer term. Firstly, revenue optimization initiatives primarily focused in our Heritage division. There are two areas: annuities in the with-profits funds totaling 4.3 billion pounds, which we're looking to move into the shareholder fund, and also asset migration with total potential assets of 66 billion pounds. Last year, we announced 2 billion of annuities from the with-profits fund and 17 billion of asset migration to Friends Life Investments. Combined, these have improved expected return by 16 million per annum starting this year. This is an important driver of the growth in expected return that Tim's just covered. Our focus in the first half of this year has been on a further 0.8 billion of annuities in the with-profits fund, together with the 14 billion of assets from F&C that we're moving primarily to Schroders as part of our new strategic partnership. We expect the combined benefits of these to be 10 million pounds per annum from 2015, so this isn't included in the expected return numbers in the current year. As you can see from the pie charts, that takes us roughly halfway through the potential revenue optimization initiatives that we can undertake. Jonathan Moss and his team have established a strong track record, so while it isn't certain that we can complete the remaining initiatives, I'm confident that if it can be done profitably, we have the team to do it. I view the revenue optimization initiatives as reducing the steeper in-force runoff in the shorter term, so the 10 million pounds here will reduce the 30 million pound runoff of the in-force book in 2015 down to just 20 million pounds, with the other growth areas then needing to more than offset this residual 20 million pound runoff. Moving on to our second area, corporate benefits. The market growth here is very strong, with assets in the corporate benefits market expected to triple over the next decade. The strength of our market position is clearly highlighted on the left-hand side of the slide. Across corporate benefits and Heritage Pensions, we have over 2 million pension customers. That's one in seven DC savers in the U.K. Our customers have 48 billion of assets under management and pay us an in-force regular premium of over 1 billion pounds per annum. All in all, we're a scale player in these markets. In terms of our delivery in the first half in corporate benefits, the key focus has been auto-enrollment, where we've auto-enrolled over 600 schemes and have in total over 100,000 net new members in the first half of this year. In addition, we've launched our new Master Trust and have developed a direct offer transfer proposition to attract in new assets alongside our new scheme wins. Here, the take-up rate is a very impressive 37%, with average transfer values of 28,000 pounds. These initiatives have been key drivers of the excellent net fund flows in the first half of 0.4 billion pounds. As you know, asset-based businesses are all about leveraging operational gearing, grow assets and income, and hold costs. That's what we're delivering, and hence we've made excellent progress in our underlying free surplus generation. So having grown significantly in 2013 from 2012, we've now done more in the first half of 2014 than we did in the whole of 2013. I recognize this is only 18 months of track record, and you all want to see this for longer. But the growth in this market will largely happen in the existing schemes, which we already have. Indeed, over 80% of our new business comes from existing schemes. And if we continue to perform as we have been, corporate benefits alone will go a long way to cover the residual runoff that we had from the previous slide. Moving on to our third area for growth, retirement income. As we covered before, we have one in nine maturing pensions in the U.K. in a market that we expect to triple in size over the next decade. Let me take a moment to set out the size of the prize, remembering this is also all about growth from our existing customer base. The chart on the left here shows our existing 48 billion of corporate benefits and Heritage Pension assets that I just covered by age of customer. Quite simply, there's a wall of money coming at us. And of course, this is just the current assets under management. This will grow through asset growth, the in-force premiums for existing customers, and the addition of new customers. The chart on the right shows the distribution of our existing pension assets by pot size. It also covers our target market, recognizing that larger pots may seek IFA advice, and smaller pots may well be cashed in. Although even cashing in a £20,000 pot will mean a big income tax bill and paying higher rate tax in many cases, which could be significantly reduced by drawing income over time. In summary, the vast majority of our existing customers are mass affluent, do not have an active IFA relationship, and are unlikely to pay fees for IFA advice. Now, given the retirement income market is the one subject to most change post the budget, I want to spend a bit more time setting out what we've been doing to drive value from our significant scale here. And I'll look to do this considering each of the three areas of the customer value chain, namely customer engagement, platform and product, and asset management. In each of these three areas, I'll share some of the headlines from the extensive customer research that we've done over the last few months, and then cover the actions we're already taking as a result. Starting first with customer engagement. Even before the budget, this was a key area of focus, and since then, we've redoubled our efforts because there's no doubt in my mind that the winners going forward will be those that engage best with their customers. This is the critical area. Headlines from our research: most customers want help but won't pay more than £500 for advice, which rules out most good IFAs. There's a huge opportunity to help customers optimize their tax position. Another fact: in both the U.S. and Australia, the significant majority of customers decumulate with their accumulation provider. In other words, the evidence from other markets is look after your customers, offer competitive products, and most will choose to stay. We have three key channels of engagement with our customers: telephony, direct mail, and online. In terms of telephony, our retirement engagement teams complete over 2,000 customer calls per month, both outbound and inbound, playing a vital role in supporting them. We're open for business when it suits our customers, providing weekend and evening appointments. We offer a dedicated retirement specialist to each customer, enabling our people to understand each customer's priorities in order to help them understand their retirement choices. In terms of direct mail, we've contacted approximately 50,000 customers so far this year, offering them support and guidance in this period of uncertainty and change immediately following the budget. By the end of the year, we will have contacted a further 100,000 customers who are reaching a critical point in their retirement journey. Those customers wishing to discuss their options in more detail will be offered one of our dedicated retirement specialists to speak to. In terms of online, our new retirement planning hub is now live on our customer website. The customer website hits increased in the month following the budget by 232% compared to the previous month. As part of our platform development, our extended customer interface will offer a single view of Friends Life holdings and, importantly, tax guidance, which customers will find hugely valuable. Lots of action underway. Is it working? What's happening today is that the annuity market is declining, the red line on the chart here, and it will have fallen even further since the year end. This is because more and more customers are deferring their retirement. Another fact for you: 80% of our customers that were due to retire in 2012 but chose to defer have still not retired now. The deferral option is good for us as we keep earning our annual management charge. The alternative to deferring is to buy a retirement income product, and pre-budget for mass affluent customers, that's an annuity. Our annuity sales in the first half of this year have been excellent and far superior to the majority of our mainstream peers. In other words, for those of our customers that choose to retire using an annuity rather than defer, far more are buying that annuity from us. I believe the reason for this, quite simply, is that we're building a distinctive capability in engaging with our customers at retirement. Yes, the product needs to be competitive, and our annuity margins are lower, as Tim covered, but they are still very profitable and better than most of our peers historically. Of course, guaranteed annuity options continue to be attractive to our customers and remain about half of our annuity sales. In terms of the independent government guidance, we said very early on that this should be provided by independent bodies, and I'm pleased that the Chancellor agrees. It will be brief and will not provide specific recommendations, so we'll be there when our customers want help in understanding their options and deciding which one to take. To summarise on customer engagement, strong delivery in the first half, as evidenced by excellent annuity sales, leaving us very well placed for the post-budget world. While I believe that customer engagement will be the key differentiator, it's also important to have a good competitive platform and product range. In terms of the research here, my favourite is that 3/4 of customers want a fixed income for life, but only 1/4 intend to buy an annuity. But it actually says quite a lot. They want simple, competitive products. So alongside our annuity product range, we need a competitive, platform-based, flexible income proposition. We're therefore investing to further build on our already market-leading corporate wrap platform by adding an individual version, which we expect to go live by April of next year. The key point I want to make here is that this platform already exists. Indeed, many of you have seen it outside as you were coming in, and is already offering our customers pensions and ISAs side by side with a broad range of funds, as well as a cash savings account, online share trading, and so on. It's already market leading in the corporate market. The largest employee benefit consultant in this market is Mercer. Their client offer is Mercer Workplace Savings, where we're one of 3 partners. And the benefits of this partnership have been a key driver of our 30% sales growth in corporate benefits in the first half that Tim just covered. This is fundamentally down to the strength of our corporate wrap platform. So while there's work to do to separate the corporate layer, further build the D2C interface and integrate to our existing products, it's a strong base on which to build our flexible income proposition. We're also planning further product delivery here, including more flexible annuities, late life income products, and a number of other ideas. All these will ensure that we have a competitive range of products to fulfil behind our strong customer engagement. The other point I'd like to draw out here is the strong complementary benefits of our business model, particularly between Heritage and the open businesses. Going forward, as I've just said, retirement income will involve both annuities and platform-based flexible income, which we're basing on our existing corporate wrap platform. Given we have pension customers in both Heritage and corporate benefits, we leverage much greater value having Heritage, corporate benefits, and retirement income all together. And finally, on retirement income, I'd like to touch on asset management, where I believe our best-of-breed model is a competitive advantage. The research tells us customers rarely know where they're invested, want a safe choice, and rarely choose high-alpha funds. The pie chart shows the asset mix on our corporate benefits book, which is typically mass affluent customers. Over 1/3 is passive, where our scale and buying power gets us extremely competitive rates. And even the active is still at a low level of basis points. In terms of key actions, we're working with Schroders to develop a new range of fund options. And we have our excellent range of Friends Life default funds, where we manage the asset allocation of underlying passive components. Nearly half of our auto-enrolment schemes have taken the Friends Life default fund. The key point to make is that our payaway is very low. So in my opinion, an in-house multi-asset manager is not necessary for us to capture value and succeed. In summary, for retirement income overall, customer engagement will be the key differentiator. We performed strongly here in the first half, and along with a competitive product, platform, product range and asset management model, I believe we're well placed to secure the wall of money as it comes through into retirement. So to conclude, we've been getting our heads down in the first half and getting on with the execution of our strategy. In terms of cash today, the Lombard disposal and increased share buyback improves our 2013 pro forma cash coverage of the dividend. And the strong performance in sustainable free surplus in the first half of this year gives us confidence in building towards our 1.3 times coverage target. Therefore, my focus is much more on growing cash tomorrow to support our future progressive dividend. I've outlined the 3 key areas here, and our delivery in the first half of this year has been strong, with a significant majority of the growth focused on our existing customer base, given its scale, which in my view makes the growth all the more attractive. Overall, I'm pleased with our execution in the first half and I'm confident we can drive growing cash going forward. And with that, we'll move on to questions. Right, we've got microphones, I think, coming down from our lovely assistants sides. Do you want to go for John first and then pass to Gordon?
Morning, it's Jon Hocking from Morgan Stanley. I've got three questions, please. Firstly, on the 1.1 billion in-force premium number you give for the corporate business, I wonder if you have the number where that inflow number is going to reach once you reach the full contribution limits for auto-enrolment. That's the first question. Second question on FPI. How confident are you that you've got enough scale in this business? Because I realize you're moving on to a new platform, but it does seem to be struggling in terms of returns. Then the third question on the capital return from the PRA. Is it too much to conclude that because you've been able to give back all of the proceeds from Lombard and that the Solvency II rules aren't yet finalized, that actually that implies you've got some underlying excess capital post-implementation of Solvency II? Thank you.
So I'll take the second of those and let Tim do the first and third. FPI scale, I mean, very, very much a scale business. Our assets under management are just under 7 billion pounds, so significantly greater than many of our UK-listed peers in that marketplace. So confident we got the scale. The embedded value is about 500 million pounds, so it's a decent size and scale business. Tim?
Thank you. Yeah, John, on the first point about auto-enrolment, there's no doubt auto-enrolment and existing schemes have been the key driver behind the fund inflows. We have seen a larger number than we would have expected of employers go with the minimum one plus one contributions. So simply through the passage of time, if we retain those schemes and we see new members come on board as we would hope to do on both, then that one plus one would rise to a total of 8% when auto-enrolment is completed in end of 2017. So what I particularly like is that we're writing this business profitably now, even on the modest level of employee and employer contributions, and that bodes very well for the efficiency and therefore the operating leverage that we should get from the business as those contributions rise in line with the legislative step changes in the future.
Did you have a feel for the number? Is it sort of 2 billion or 2.5 billion in terms of the step up for the extra contribution?
No, but I can't give you that because that would depend upon understanding the distinct averages of how many are at one plus one and not. What we have seen is average contributions that we are receiving from employers are down quite a bit. That is the effect of auto-enrolment and of companies averaging down to lower contributions overall. But clearly, I mean, I'm particularly pleased with the performance, and that was why I described it as terrific. If you can write it profitably and grow your operating leverage when contributions are modest, then that bodes well for the future. I think it absolutely vindicates the decisions taken probably 18 months ago to focus on auto-enrolling our existing customers, where you've incurred all the infrastructure costs, you've got the setup, you've got the funds designed, you've got the electronic straight-through processing with the HR departments of the employers. So your overheads are relatively fixed, and you can just put the additional volume coming through. That's why we're still writing business profitably, even the finer margin that you get on auto-enrolment. So it stokes the boiler well for the future there. In terms of your last point, John, on capital, I mean, we were particularly pleased to get the PRA's approval to the larger buyback. So initially, we announced just the upfront cash consideration from Sale Lombard, so 261 million pounds. What we've now agreed is that the full initial consideration, so effectively distributing via a share buyback, the financial element, which is the vendor loan note, which actually we won't receive for some 8 years down the track. I mean, that's a strong indication of both our, so the board's confidence in the strength of the balance sheet and our capital position and financial prospects. But I think it's also clear that the regulator has taken a similar view in forming their position on it. I don't think you can necessarily leap to a position that says there must therefore be an excess because the industry is still working through Solvency II, still waiting to see that land. And as I said back in March, I said then that we didn't see material distributions of capital from organic activities until Solvency II is in and calibrated, and I still stand by that. But we went into this year and finalizing Solvency II with a very strong economic capital position. Not saying that's the same as Solvency II, but clearly the two to agree to align because they form from an economic base. So I think it's a very strong statement about our capital position.
Gordon.
And Gordon Aitken from RBC. So we heard yesterday that the corporate pensions, the prize isn't necessarily auto-enrollment, but the prize is mopping up employers, what are very messy pensions arrangements and several schemes within each employer. Do you agree with this? And can you maybe give us an indication of what proportion of the FTSE 100 and 350 where you have relationships, some pensions relationships, and are you well placed to pick up these sort of consolidated mandates? That's the first question. Second, on annuities, bulks, you talked about perhaps you're going to enter and have a look at this market and just give us an update on that. And third, on the guaranteed annuity options, can you just tell us what the shape of that book is, please?
Okay, so I'll take the first two. I mean, the headline for me in corporate benefits is that assets will triple over the next decade, and it's all about allowing your income to go up in line with assets, and then largely holding costs, and that's the operational gearing. That's what we're delivering in our business at the moment. And there's a range of sources of where that growth will come from, but the reality is that the vast majority will come from the existing schemes already in place. As the number two player in the market, no big surprise, we're the number two player in terms of the schemes, and our focus is very much the mid to larger employers within the marketplace. So I think there'll be a range of sources of that. I think it is quite likely that customers will consolidate more of their assets together in a platform-based world. And that's where I'm particularly pleased, as I said in my prepared comments, that we've been working with the new schemes we've been bringing on with a direct offer transfer. The take-up rate's been 37%. I mean, if you do direct offer marketing, 1% is a take-up rate you might expect in many areas. We've got 37% of customers are taking that up with an average transfer value coming in of £28,000. And that's one of the important drivers of the strong net fund flows. So I think there's a whole host of drivers in corporate benefits that the key is disciplined financial management, scale of existing book, the growth will happen in the existing schemes, controlling the costs as that growth comes through. And we're very confident we're well placed for that to be a key driver of growth for us. In terms of, I'll do bulk annuities and then let Tim do the
GOs.
Yeah. So on bulk annuities, the work we're doing there continues. I mean, so far this year we've probably seen about 30 billion of de-risking activity from the bulk annuity and longevity swap market, but that's only in a pool of over a trillion of DB assets. So and that trillion of DB assets, generally finance directors don't want that on their balance sheet and would like to de-risk it. So although it's grown a lot at 30 billion so far this year, it's still 3% of the available market size, if you like. There are quite significant barriers to entry in terms of that marketplace, but equally I think we're over the significant majority of them. So you need a strong longevity understanding, which we clearly have for our existing annuity business. You need strong relationships with employee benefit consultants and large employers. Well, we have that as a number two player in the corporate benefit market. You also need to be able to transition assets. But remember, when we did the $2 billion with-profit annuity reallocation last year, the majority of the assets that we brought across from the with-profit fund into the shareholder fund were gilts. And within 3 months, we managed to restructure those assets into the format, or largely into the format that we wanted them. So we've got the core capabilities that represent those significant barriers to entry. And therefore, it's an area where we're continuing to actively consider.
On your GO question, Gordon, we see for the next 3, 4, 5 years an average of £250 million per annum of GAO business. That's what we said back at Q1. That was on the basis of expecting a circa only about a 20% decline in take-up of annuities from GAO-related products. That itself is, of course, is a dynamic that's driven by two things mainly. Firstly, obviously, is interest rates. And secondly, that the average uplift that we're seeing last year, I don't have a stat in my head for the first half of this year, so the uplift from the fund value to purchase the annuity that is embedded in the guarantee was well north of 40%. So these products still represent significant value for customers, which is why we think in that sort of medium-term time frame, the market for those will shrink much less than for general annuities. Probably most of that shrinkage will probably happen in the very small fund sizes as well, where people may well just take advantage of the expanded triviality rules.
Okay, next questions. Andrew at the end.
It's Andrew Crean at Autonomous. Three questions. When I look at your sensitivities on your capital ratios, both economic and IGD, to the economic, you know, I think you test for 40% fall in equities and properties and risk-free falling through the floor and credit spreads expanding. Yes. I mean, you're still very financially strong. What is it that the PRA worries about beyond there, which we can't see when we test? Secondly, could you talk a bit on the corporate benefit side? I think the government has capped at 75 basis points, but it says it will keep returning to the level of the cap from 2017 on. To what extent are you concerned that the massive tripling in the asset build-up, which will be delivered by auto-enrollment, will be consistently offset by further margin or revenue cut by the government? And then thirdly, can you explain a little bit more about the amount that you're spending on platforms and new products? I think you said 30 million this year. Could you give us the targeted spend across 2014-15, and how does that row into the SFS? Because you said you're going to have it as a broken out line. Would that be part of the sustainable free surplus or below it?
Why don't I do one and three?
Perfect. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah, he always gives me the easy ones, Andrew, which is what I appreciate. Firstly, on the PRA, I'm not sure what the PRA worries about, and I can't suggest that you ask them because they wouldn't tell you either. But I think I would agree with you that we have a very strong balance sheet. I would agree with you that the sensitivities are clearly manageable within our capital base. I think that we won't, as an industry, see material returns of capital, except from, you know, inorganic activity like we have demonstrated. I think my confidence in the balance sheet position, and if I'm allowed to interpret that as the regulator's confidence, but I can't confirm it, obviously, that's for their own view. The fact that we've been allowed to distribute an amount of surplus, in inverted commas, capital equivalent to the vendor loan note that won't actually be received for 8 years, I think is as clear a testament I can give that we're confident in the strength of our capital position as we go into Solvency II. I think the whole industry needs to wait until Solvency II is in and the regulator has calibrated it. So therefore, I don't think we suddenly all know the answer on, you know, 1/1/16 or 31/12/16. But we clearly go into this from a very strong position. So I'm very comfortable in our capital position. In terms of the platform costs, yeah, you're absolutely right. I am carving that out from sustainable free surplus, and therefore sustainable free surplus guidance. And I think it will be fairly safe to assume that the board would also set it aside when looking at dividend policy and the like. And the reason I say that, Andrew, is because the Chancellor, in his own words, described this as the biggest change in pensions and taxation of pensions since 1921. So I think if ever I've got something that I could regard as a non-recurring type item, this is probably it. But generally speaking, platform and product development is what we pay with the development spend line. And so it is only the platform and product related costs associated with the stuff that Andy was showing on target income. It is only those costs that I think it would be appropriate to call out as a separate item outside of the SFS guidance for 4 year, outside of dividend policy. Don't expect to spend more than 30 million this year. Haven't put a number on it for next, but I think you could read into that if I was particularly worried, I would have said something on the future.
And should you see the development costs coming down as you make this spend elsewhere?
No, I've said we would expect to see materially less than the £15 million growth in development spend that we described with year-end results, because the majority of that was targeted against retirement income. So obviously what we did post-budget, which was literally the day after we gave the guidance on that dev spend, was we reviewed those programmes. Most of them are being scaled back in order to create intellectual capacity within the business to put our experts and platform and IT capability, get the experts working on what should now be the shape of the proposition and platform for working in the post-April 2015 world.
Okay, and to the corporate benefits, so as you rightly say, that qualifying schemes under auto-enrolment are to be capped at 75 basis points. What we said back in May is that, and you see in our results today, is that there's a non-operating impact on MCV of £50 million as a result of that. But we also expect that the ban on commission going forward means that effectively the cash and IFRS impact will be negligible. If you look at our corporate benefit book overall, the 60 basis points is the figures we've covered here today, and you've seen from my asset management slide, roughly 10 basis points of that is asset management. If people choose to go passive, and effectively it's default funds in the capping, then you kind of save the significant majority of that. And then roughly 10 basis points of the 60 would be commission in today's world, which obviously wouldn't then, you know, that's historical commission, if you like, or historical products that wouldn't then be covered by the charge caps. I mean, ultimately, it depends, you know, where the government goes to on this in due course, if indeed they do go further. But we're already operating on a sort of default-based, non-commission basis in corporate benefits, you know, significantly below 50 basis points. I mean, the other point I'm probably worth drawing out is that the £50 million that we've covered is actually, it looks pretty modest compared to some numbers I've seen from some others as well. So, you know, our book is reasonably modern and new compared to some. Other questions? Alan, over this side.
Thanks, Alan Devon from Barclays. A couple of questions. First on the FPI. First of all, is it core? Second is the platform spend you're making. Will that have any financial benefits when it's done, or is it just to make the platform competitive in the market? And then finally, on the dividend being cut, the interim dividend being cut, you know, given your SFS are still positive, so still cash generative, is that more to do with the capital requirements moving to Hong Kong? And then a final question on the impact of interest rates. You know, a couple of years ago, you said interest rates would be a 50 million headwind to SFS. If short-term rates do move up in the second half of the year, you know, how quickly can we see that come back into SFS? Thanks.
Okay, I'll take the... I think I had three there. I'll take the first and let Tim deal with the dividend and interest rates. So, I mean, our philosophy across the group as a whole is to secure maximum value from each part of the group and always has been. So in Heritage, that means the revenue optimization initiatives we're undertaking. What it's meant in UK is getting out of the unprofitable product areas, ensuring we only redeploy capital profitably. For Lombard, what it meant was sell the business. That's how we thought we'd secure maximum value from each part of the group, or from that part of the group for shareholders. For FPI, what it means is we think it's right to invest in building FPI onto its own standalone platform that will work with Asian time zones, languages, and currencies. And yes, we do expect, you know, significant benefits from that. Ultimately, it will be a bespoke platform that works better with Asian time zones, languages, and currencies, a more modern platform. And ultimately, we wouldn't be making the investment if we didn't think there would be benefits for shareholders from it.
Okay, so continuing on FPI then, in relation to its dividend position. Yeah, yes, positive SFS from FPI at the half year. Not as positive as we would have liked it to be, quite clearly. I think it's important to differentiate between an international dividend and SFS. I mean, I know another company who's reporting today, apparently, in their cash measure, have it as a UK-based plus dividends received from overseas. Our SFS measure reflects the sustainable free surplus generation of all of our businesses. So a dividend payable from international to group would not show in our sustainable free surplus. That would simply be a transfer of free surplus from one entity to another, whereas our SFS measure is a generation of free surplus across the group. In terms of how that impacts with capital, so we have seen a number of factors affecting the capital position of FPIL in the first half, partly trading, so it's generating less than we had desired it to. Secondly, currency movements have probably cost it, you know, £4 or 5 million in terms of balance sheet surplus capital and impact its ratios. On this Hong Kong binding capital constraint, it's probably just worth stepping back and thinking about how the rules work here. So in the Isle of Man regulations, you have a completely mechanistic approach to it, which provides for your capital based upon the funds under management of your business. And it's fairly crude and doesn't take a great deal of impact associated with the profile of the business you're writing. whereas the Hong Kong rules, which, because that's just a division of the group, apply to the whole of FPIL, much more like the UK rules that look at your reserves, look at the kind of business you're writing, apply different factors to different types of business. So there's nothing that's changing in the Hong Kong capital rules. It is simply that the mix of business we're writing recently has seen more protection business sold in FPIL. So under the Isle of Man rules, that doesn't really make a great deal of difference. The way the Hong Kong rules mean is that's actually increasing the regulatory capital requirements. So I think if sales mix continues in a certain pattern, then it is possible in the second half we will see the Hong Kong rules becoming the biting constraint rather than the Isle of Man rules as they are today. That could further impact on full-year dividend capacity, all other things being equal. So that's why we've decided it's prudent to pass on it at the half year and not give ourselves a, you know, too tight a capital position at half year, which is never a clever thing to do. And we'll keep it under review for the second half. So it's not a shift in the rules, it's more a shift in the profile of the business and how the different rule sets apply to the balance sheet. So I apologise for the long answer, Alan, but I hope that puts a bit more colour on it for everybody. Does that answer your question on that?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Yeah, there was another point. Yeah. Question 14. I missed that one.
Can you do this one in less than 5 minutes? Then?
Yeah. It would be beneficial. I mean, if long-term rates only rise in line with the curve, then no, it wouldn't make a difference. At the short end, yes, if we saw a rise in short-term rates when we reset things at the start of the year, then that would be beneficial to our capital and available shareholder cash figure, except for the element that we've already effectively accelerated that return by investing some in syndicated loans. So yes, beneficial, but not quite to the scale that I'd have given you 2 years ago.
Go to Oliver, then Blair.
I'll speed up.
I'll be quick. Oliver Steele, Deutsche Bank. At the year end, you seemed to imply that you were thinking about M&A acquisitions, as well as disposals, I guess. I wonder if you could just update us on your thoughts about acquisitions.
Well, the day after we said that, the budget happened, yeah? So, I mean, our view is that, yes, we definitely still see, in fact, if anything, I would say that post the budget, further consolidation in the UK life sector is more likely, because ultimately more of the business is going to be asset-based. Asset-based is more about scale, and therefore consolidation is more likely. I think that's a pretty fairly widely held view around the market. We would remain interested in participating within that. Ultimately, we think we've demonstrated a distinctive capability and track record in driving value for shareholders from inorganic activity, but remain of the view that we don't need to. We have a strong, healthy, organic future as a group, given the scale of the customer base and the range of things that we've already talked about this morning. So we remain interested in considering that in due course, if it would drive incremental value on top of the already attractive organic future that we have as a group.
Thank you very much. It's Blair Stewart from BofA Merrill. Two questions. Firstly, you talked about your retirement specialist advice team. Could you go into a bit more detail about what these people are actually doing? You know, how far are they going with advice, and how that maybe dovetails into the guidance process that's going to come in? And secondly, on the platform, I think it was thought about and then dismissed in the past by this group, albeit under a different management team, and I can see why you're doing it now, but can you talk a little about how you expect the economics of the platform to play out on the assumption that most of the assets go to third-party asset managers? What's in it for you in terms of revenue and cost margin, please?
Sure. So taking the first one first, the team of retirement specialists have a number of QCF Level 4 qualified individuals. So effectively, that's the IFA standard of financial qualification. Today, we are not giving advice to customers, so we're giving education, information, guidance. We're not giving advice today. What we envisage this evolving at over time is, I mean, ideally, and we're working with the FCA on this, along with other members of the ABI, to try and create a guidance regime that sits somewhere between education and information and if you like, full fat advice. So ideally, we would get into that space. We haven't ruled out giving advice, but we haven't made the decision to do it either at this stage. I do think for most mass affluent customers, actually the income tax position is going to be one of the most important questions they need to ask. They need to basically understand their options understand the different elements of their options, and therefore I think just helping them understand those and what the options might look like will be the key and to optimise their tax position as part of it. In terms of how it fits with the government guidance, I mean, as I said in my prepared words, we were always of the view that that should be provided by an independent body, and we were one of the first to come out and say so, and I'm pleased that the Chancellor agrees with that. It's going to be, we'll see how it develops, but my expectation is it'll be a 15 to 30 minute conversation where the customer will start to get an understanding of broadly what their options might look like, but at the end of it, they're going to have a whole series of questions. And ultimately, we want to be there for our customers to help them think through those questions and think through their options and then help them decide what it is that they want to do. In terms of the platform, the economics, again, as I sort of touched on and what I said earlier on, mass affluent customers don't buy high alpha funds. They basically go typically for the passive or the default-based funds. And therefore, the level of asset management, if I look at corporate benefits, as I said a moment ago, the 60 basis points, that there's around 10 basis points of that is the asset management fees. We're seeing virtually half of our auto-enrolment clients selecting our own default fund, where effectively we're doing the asset allocation on top of passive components. Given our scales, we get those passive components at really very, very low level of basis points indeed. So my view is that the pay away for mass affluent customers is very low, and you don't need an in-house multi-asset manager to be able to secure value and compete successfully and profitably in that marketplace. I think the key point here is the customer segmentation. So an awful lot of the comment around the budget is all about high net worth individuals, the sorts of people that will, you know, pay the 150 basis points on their platform for high alpha funds and everything else. Mass affluent customers aren't like that. They're different. So I think it's really important to understand that the segmentation of the market. There is an opportunity in that high net worth space, which isn't what we're targeting, to target customers with high alpha funds with very high margins on, and the players that choose to do that, I'm sure, will do very well. In the mass affluent space, customers don't go for those high alpha funds. I think that was your two questions, yeah?
Yeah, thank you.
Ravi.
Thanks. Ravi Tanna from Goldman Sachs. Just two questions, please. The first one was on auto-enrolment, and forgive me if you've already kind of answered this, but just trying to get some clarity on going forward, the smaller schemes that come through under auto-enrolment, do they... my reading of it is that perhaps they aren't meeting the hurdle rates in terms of profitability. Is that a fair assumption, given your emphasis on enrolling existing schemes? And can you perhaps talk a little bit about the profitability of those schemes going forward? And the second one was just on Solvency II. And you laid out on slide 21 the various measures or capacity for extracting cash from the heritage book. I'm just wondering, are any of those at all Solvency II contingent, or do you see... Clearly, Solvency II is still developing, but do you see opportunities there for a further extraction of cash from the back book as a result of that?
Okay, so I'll let Tim take the second one. In terms of the first one, historically, our view is the most profitable segment of the market has been the medium to large employers. So the super large employers tend to get competed to, they're sort of trophy schemes and get competed to very, very low levels of basis points. And historically, the smaller employers have tended to be, more advised on an IFA commission basis. So we'll see how that smaller end of the market plays out in due course in terms of the profitability, because clearly post-RDR, the dynamics there will be different. And we are doing more work in that segment of the market than we have done historically. But our core focus is on that mid to large employer segment where we have, you know, where we have our scale. And it is, at the end of the day, corporate benefits, it's a scale game. If you've got the scale, you can drive the operating leverage and you can drive, you know, strong year-on-year growth in cash generation. If you don't have the scale, it's a much, much tougher to get to that break-even point. Tim, do you want to cover the second?
Yeah, certainly. So, Ravi, there are two types of initiatives on that slide. There are the asset restructuring and potential migrations. I mean, those would work either way, because they are simply, if you look, there is a clear cash benefit, a recurring cash benefit, that comes from being able to restructure those. But the most one of the most important considerations we have in those is actually making sure that we're giving our customers the best chance of having a superior investment return. That's right at the core of what we do. If we can do that and achieve a benefit for the shareholders at the same time, then terrific, and that's primarily through a cash lens. As for the with-profit annuity reallocations, which is the other part of slide 21, then we're already looking at those on an economic capital return basis as well. So I'm quite comfortable that although we haven't seen finally calibrated Solvency II, that we're looking, and we did, you know, the first and the second one, we're looking at them through all those lenses. But, you know, and Andy's prepared words, you know, he said, I won't try and quote you, but basically, if anybody can write these things profitably, we've got the team to do it. That assessment will include looking at them on an economic basis, not just a pillar one.
Back to John.
Thank you. In the statement, there's this quite a strange comment that during the transition to Solvency II, the group will need to hold its capital in a different way and will be adjusted appropriately. I wonder what you meant by that.
I'd have to find that. It's probably a reference to the fact that we said back at year end that we intend to apply for internal model approval in the middle of 2016 and hope to get approved by the end of 16. So technically we'll be reporting under a standard formula during 2016, but I don't expect whatever that shows for us to reap any kind of a benefit if there is one, because we'll already be looking through at an advanced stage on what we think internal models will be. So I think it's probably referring to that, but if that doesn't match it when you look back at it, come find me afterwards.
Back to Andrew.
Yes, just coming back on your capital optimization or cash optimization program, the 2015 onwards, I mean, you didn't give any sense as to what kind of benefit you'd hope to gain from that. Should we look at it pro rata to the amount of assets, or should we take a more cautious view? And is that a 15 thing, or is quite a lot of the asset transfer likely to be somewhere out in 2017, 18, 19?
So we've not given specific guidance going forward on the remaining elements. In terms of the with-profit annuity side of it, you know, we look at each tranche on its merits, and ultimately you can kind of see the pace at which we're doing those tranche by tranche already to give you a sense of timing going forward. In terms of the asset migration side, those are the assets that are currently with AXA investment managers. And I've said before that the nature of the agreement there means that the break fee involved in that halves in the second half of next year. Now, obviously, we haven't, you know, made any decisions around what we may or may not do with that, but that would be the logical time to think about whether it was appropriate to restructure those arrangements in any way. Back to Alan.
Thanks. Just one question on your retirement portal. Is that going to be portable? We heard Standard Life yesterday talk about their corporate benefits platform will be portable, and they can basically build a direct model by stealth. And you guys don't have the IFA channel to worry about either. So can you use this platform to go direct to consumers? Thanks.
It already is direct to consumers. So the people who use the platform today are employees of pension schemes. They're on there using it. They are putting money into their ISAs and buying their ISAs, they're reorganising their funds between their pensions and ISAs and choosing the multitude of different fund options within there. They're doing their share trading online today on that platform. So it already is a consumer platform, an employee platform. What we're basically going to do is to extend out that consumer interface. So at the moment, you've got to be a member of a corporate pension scheme to be able to use it, but it's the employees that use it. So we're going to basically build that front-end interface for all of our customers, whether they're in a pension scheme or not, to be able to use it, and link it into the underlying products that we have, so that if you're a customer in Heritage, you can go into that front-end and you can see your Heritage products from that front end. What's likely at retirement, it seems to me, and we'll see how it develops in due course, but what's likely is that heritage customer may well say, actually, you know what, I want to move across onto the platform itself, so I've got my pension and ISA side by side. So when they take their tax-free cash, you know, if they're not using it to pay down debt, then you know, put it in the ISA on the platform, keep it invested as you choose to. So we do see some movement between the different books of business as we bring it together, which is why I made the point about the complementary benefits of the different parts of the group. So it's an existing platform; it's already there. Employees are already using it in our corporate benefit business. It's one of the key drivers of the 30% sales growth that we covered earlier on, and hence the financial performance there.
But if an employee leaves the employer and changes jobs, can he still use the My Money as his retirement savings vehicle?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, yeah, and of our 1.25 million corporate pension customers that we covered earlier on, probably about a third have left their employer, and they're effectively our direct customers. Any final questions? Nigel owes me a drink if I get you away from here by 10 to 10, I think. All done. Okay, well, look, thanks very much indeed for coming along this morning. And as ever, don't hesitate to bring any follow-up questions that you have either to Tim and I or to Jana and the IR team. But thanks very much for coming along. See you soon.